Hello, and welcome to the Sunday Afternoon Podcast with Greg Reese. I am your host, Greg Reese. Today is Sunday, April 14th, 2024. You caught me pre-recording it. It is actually April 13th right now. I'm recording an intro. This is an intro. I'm going to give a little intro for a couple reasons. And then we're going to get into an interview with Dr. Michael Sala. One of the reasons is because I know you guys like to hear me pluck on the banjo. Was made for the Star Spangled Banner. I noticed that the other day when I was just laying on the couch. Like the way it's tuned, the open tuning. So, anyways. Well, I guess I'll twang a little bit. Here's what I'm working on lately. Heard me do if you're a long time listener, you've heard me do a variation of that before. It's a little different one, the one that's like. So it's a what do you call that? It's an old traditional one, clinch mountain backstep, I think is what it's called. One of my faves. And I found another banjo. I told you, I think, before, like, I got this one. It took me a while in Russia to get a decent banjo. And this one is like a starter model. It's a decent little recording king, but it's a cheapy beginner's model. And I just wanted to sort of test the waters of this shipment deal. And now I got a better one coming. I got basically the same thing I had in America coming. It's a step up, actually, a little bit of a step up. So I'm excited. I'll have a real traditional pre-war style American banjo. And now that the weather's getting nice, I can open my windows and fill the streets of Moscow with the sounds of American bluegrass. And I can guarantee you they're going to appreciate that here. So there you go, folks. And then we'll have more banjo picking in the future. I'm still kind of rusting, getting the rust off my fingers from not having it for a few months. But it's coming quick. Got me a metronome. And yeah, pretty excited. I got a proper drum head tool so I can get my drum head nice and tuned properly. So yeah, there will be more banjo picking in the future. And I'll most likely be making some connections here to play with some folks. Some Russian folk instruments combined with the banjo. That's the best way to bridge the peace, in my opinion, is through music. Another thing I wanted to mention, the reason I'm doing a little intro here is I've never done an affiliate thing where I offer products to you, but I'm doing my first one this week, and it's because it's something that I think is important. It's something I want, and I figured some of you guys would probably, since we're kind of birds of a feather flock together, a lot of us are very similar-minded thinking. I was guessing a lot of you guys are going to be interested in this too. It is a company called Privacy Academy, with Glenn and Eric Metter, and I'm just reading off their website here. You are being spied on, and we are here to help. You are being spied on by big tech, big brother, and creeps online at all times. Your location is constantly tracked, texts are being read, and the cameras and microphones on your device can be turned on without your knowledge. Information is power. That's why they are trying to get as much as yours as possible. And they are here to teach how to fix it. And there's a lot of characters. Like for here, they got a quote from Connor Boyack, the author. I interviewed Connor Boyack. That was a good interview. He's quoted here on their website. Online privacy is one of the most important issues of our time. It's essential that parents and children learn how to protect themselves and their freedom. Glenn is an excellent teacher and is an expert at taking complicated subjects and making them simple. So I'm going to have him on this Wednesday, April 17th at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time for a live webinar. I will be present, and I invite as many of you that are free to be present as well. It's going to be a live webinar with a Q&A period, so they're going to give some valuable information on what we can do to protect ourselves online and basically the overall reality of the situation. Because I shouldn't say this, but you know, I'm admitting my I do nothing. Okay, I gotta figure out like some basic steps to protect my privacy online. Because I do have some stalkers now. That comes with the territory. When you have popular videos, you get some haters and some stalkers. So I got to do something. So that's my plan. I'm going to be there this Wednesday at noon. I'm also going to put out a post about this probably tomorrow or Monday. Inviting everyone with the registration link. Like right now I'm just talking about it, but I'll have the registration link out in your email in the next 2 days. The webinar on Wednesday is free. There will be some information, a Q&A, and then they're going to offer the package to really commit and get into it and figure out how to protect yourself online. So I invite you to do that. And I'll be there too. And it looks good. Like I said, this is something that I need. You know, for a while, I almost assumed since I was a kid that we're being spied on. I used to feel that people were looking in through my windows. And I don't necessarily mean like creepy neighbors. I mean like government or aliens. You know, I always felt that I was being spied on my whole life. And so I kind of got used to it. And my attitude has been very lax in that sense. I'm like, what are you going to do? You know, you can't hide. There's no escaping it. And what I've realized lately is that's not really a good attitude. I mean, I guess that's a decent attitude at a certain level. Like, okay, what can I do about the aliens, right? I don't know if there's anything I can do about the aliens. But when it comes to, you know, criminals and thugs and haters and stalkers and government even, you know, there are things we can do to protect ourselves and our information from that. Or at least if there is, I want to know about it. So that'll be this Wednesday, April 17th at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Expect the email. If you're interested and you want to join, then keep an eye out for that email and there'll be a registration link to sign up and join me there on noon. So that's that. What else besides banjo and security before we get into Michael Sala? Expect in about a week, I have a fairly big announcement that I'll be making, change of my career path to a certain extent, to a big extent. And it could not be possible without your support here on Substack. Thanks to your support on Substack, you put me in a position of independence where I'm able to make this decision. So that'll be coming out in a week. And I guess that's it. You can check out my show, America 24, that I'm shooting live here in Moscow on YouTube. It's also going out to a Russian audience, being translated in real time. The main idea is to give people here an idea of what's going on in America from a perspective other than CNN. And so our most recent episode we had on Vivian Kubrick and Todd Callender, who's always an interesting guest. And speaking of Todd Callender, we're going to also have another person from his crew. I got to schedule with her. I have to reply to her and schedule with her. But I'm sure a lot of you guys know her from other interviews, new to me. I'm scanning. Melissa McCatty. She's a Pfizer whistleblower. And that's been my main focus with guests on the podcast lately is the vax, the shot. Because what I mean, it's the biggest story. It's huge. It's interesting here in Russia, people don't really care about it. They're not interested in it. I don't know what that means. I guess it means that they didn't get sucker punched with it like we did, like a lot of us did, not just America, but most Western countries. It's by far the biggest story, right? It's like the biggest story in all of history, but not everywhere in the world. Not everyone seems to have gotten the massive sucker punch that we did. And my next report, I think, is going to be pretty interesting. I just got, if you haven't seen it yet, Z Media. That's right. Z Media from Australia. She just put out she doesn't miss a thing. I mean, she catches all these big stories. She just put out this video from 2013, 2015, 2013. This guy from an Israeli college, and it's about how this Israeli university partnered with Pfizer on these programmable nanobots that you can inject with a syringe. And he's showing these photographs of what they look like under a microscope. And it's exactly what we're dealing with today. And apparently Pfizer kind of erased all this information afterwards. But that's what's happening. I think it's pretty clear. So unbelievable. Maria Z caught this and just put it out. So if you haven't heard this yet, you can check her out. I'm looking at her Twitter right now, Z Media Official. And she's got a thread going here about it. And it's just one more reason why I'm glad I didn't get the shot. I mean, I didn't come close to getting the shot. I've been anti-vax since I was a child, so. And if you did, I'm sorry to hear it. I think there are solutions. I think there are remedies. I think we talked about that in the past, and I don't have any absolute evidence, but I believe there's got to be a remedy. The body is a miraculous divine instrument that we were given by God, and it can cleanse itself. It can heal. So I'm sure there's a way. Stay positive. All right. My next guest, or my guest, actually, right after this little rant of mine that I've been going on for about 14 minutes. So that works out perfect. It's going to be about an hour and 20 today, which is the usual time, is Dr. Michael Sala. I've been waiting for a few weeks to talk to him. Very interesting conversation that we just had. I did take a bunch of notes because I didn't want there to be, any dead time. And it would have never, I could have talked to him for 2 hours. It was very interesting, and I think most of you guys are going to love it. There are some of you, though, who I think roll your eyes at the idea of non-human creatures or aliens or whatever you want to call them, and that's fine. To each his own. I would argue that you've been conditioned to be that way. That's my opinion. And we get into that in this conversation I have with him, because really it's just in the modern era, just in like the past 100 years, where we've been conditioned to laugh at the idea. Because if you go back just prior to 100 years ago, then you'll see that it's not funny. It's never been funny. It's always been a real subject, you know. In all of history, whether they're called giants or Nephilim or Anunnaki or whatever, you know, they're a part of our life. Today, our guest is Dr. Michael Sala, who is a scholar in international politics, a professor, and a leading figure in exopolitics for the past 20 years. Dr. Michael Sala, good to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time to join me. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on your show, Greg.
Well, thank you. Just to start off with, I was curious about what you were doing before you got into exopolitics. I understand it says, you know, international politics, conflict resolution, but I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And then what got you into the work that you're doing today? What made you decide to shift gears into exopolitics?
Yeah, sure. I was actually a professor in international politics, and my specialty was international conflict. And so I was a full-time faculty member in the Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University in Washington, D.C. So I was always interested in conflict and understanding global conflict and what causes it. So, yeah, the more I studied it, the deeper I began to look at some of these issues. And so in 2001, I heard the Disclosure Project press conference that Stephen Greer organized. And when I watched that, I realized, wow, this is the missing link. This explains the kind of deeper level of what's going on in international politics. Because if you just look at the surface layer, it all seems to be about, you know, major states, political leaders, economic processes, but there's something behind it. And when you start looking at the UFO extraterrestrial cover-up issue, you start to unravel what it is that's really driving international conflict, that it's not, international conflict is not a dysfunctional part of a kind of a functional international system. It's actually a functional part of a dysfunctional system. So that's how I got interested in it. And the more I've been researching it, the more I now understand that everything that we see at a global level in terms of international conflict, most of it can be traced back to this extraterrestrial cover-up in some way.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think I don't like the word envy, but I admire you for your work, because I would love to focus mostly on what you're doing, because the more time goes by, the more I believe that all the politics stuff, it's really just distraction from what's really going on at the highest levels. Like, it seems like the New World Order has been here for thousands of years. And what we're seeing in the public is all just a show for what's really going on behind it. That leads me to the next question, because it sounds like you were just easily able to shift gears after seeing Stephen Greer's disclosure and the cover up that's been going on. And that's my next question. Is, I find a lot of the people listening to this are going to be in total agreeance with what we're talking about, and nodding their heads. And then there are a lot of people that have just been conditioned to laugh at the subject and roll their eyes at it as if it's nonsense. I would argue that is deliberate brainwashing that occurred probably starting in the 50s, from what I can tell, because if you go back in history, any time before the 50s, it was never silly. It was never something that people laughed at. It's in fact written into our history all the way back until Sumer. You know, every holy scripture talks about non-humans, and even just, you can find newspaper clippings from early 1900s where it was not a laughing matter, but now it is. What's your take on that? And how are you able to sift through the disinformation or misinformation, if you will, that's more, I think, prevalent in this subject than any other subject.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on. And I think when I first started to explore it, you know, looking at the Stephen Greer information, at first it was like, okay, there's this cover-up happening and the government and the intelligence community doesn't want you to know that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. And then as you study it more, it goes into these deeper layers of, well, there's the kind of the black budget side of things where you have all of this massive amount of money being raised off the books to fund these secret projects that no one in Congress or none of the elected representatives in any government are aware of this because it's all being done off the books. So you have an organization like the CIA set up and it does a lot of really kind of illegal things. And, you know, the CIA actually was set up to be this giant money laundering operation where they could do all sorts of things to raise money for these secret projects that are conducted without any transparency, any accountability. And so the more you look at that, it then becomes a question of consciousness. It's like, well, the people that are doing this, you know, they're deliberately wanting to dumb down the mass consciousness. They're deliberately wanting to make people uninformed, confused, easily manipulated. And then it's like, well, it gets into the area of, well, you know, who are the elites behind all of this? And so you get the whole David Icke thing of like the shape-shifting reptilians, the adrenochrome drinking, the need for this kind of hidden class to exploit humanity in total, you know, that where there's 8 billion of us and that our energy is harvested, louche is a term that's often used, for these kind of beings that are here that are manipulating us at every level.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting things I've heard you talk about, you're the only one I've heard say this, and I keep repeating it because it's fascinating, is the idea that these reptilians were forced to retreat, to leave recently, because I've been saying, I haven't done a report on it, but I've been saying it to my friends since 2017, probably, that the leaders on the world stage are acting desperate and afraid and clumsy and stupid. And I've been paying attention to this kind of thing for decades, and they never act like that. They always act confident and in control and calculated. And it seems as if they've been left like holding the ball, and like whoever was calling the shots, whoever was making all the big decisions is gone, and they are now left alone and they don't know what to do. And so they're just like throwing every little part of the plan that they know about out into the world and to see if something will work, and nothing seems to be working. So it seemed, you know, and then a lot of what I've learned about these non-humans is that they have to obey by the law of free will. They cannot meddle with human affairs. But it seems like the reptilians have been breaking that law for quite some time. What can you tell us about that, about the reptilians' free will and this idea that they were forced to leave?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I mean, when we're talking about reptilians, we have to understand that, you know, there's an indigenous reptilian race on the Earth that go back hundreds of thousands, millions of years. You know, they even predate the human presence. I mean, that my research has kind of showed that, you know, we, humanity, that we're kind of like a more recent phenomenon on the surface of this planet, that if you go far enough back in history, the surface of this planet was a reptilian one. Then at some point in our history, 65 million years ago, the reptilian presence on the surface was wiped out, and it was like a reset. And the ones that on the surface either left to go off planet or they went underground, and they'd been underground for millions of years. And then you had these other races, human-looking races, coming in, and they set up all these genetic experiments all over the surface of the planet. And the most recent one of those arrivals were this group called the Anunnaki, and they came around 300,000 years ago. And so the surface of the planet does have all of these human extraterrestrial experiments, and there are approximately 22 of them. The different genotypes, physiologies, all trace to these different extraterrestrial groups. And at some point, another group of reptilians arrived. These are the Draco reptilians, and they they reached agreements with some of the Earth or some of these human-looking extraterrestrial factions, especially the Anunnaki, that there were agreements reached. And so then you have the destruction of Atlantis. You have Earth going into this phase of for thousands of years of kind of like having to reestablish civilization. And this is where these Draco reptilians played a big role in kind of like manipulating Earth consciousness and humanity. And they've been doing that for a long time. And recently, according to some of the sources, you have the arrival or the return of these human seeder groups. These very advanced intergalactic human-looking extraterrestrials have arrived back in our solar system. They've been gone for tens of thousands of years. They've come back, and they're kind of here to watch, well, how has their experiment progressed? And the Draco reptilians that had arrived and were messing everything up, you know, they've had to leave. And what's left is that their former minions, what we call the deep state, the cabal, the Illuminati, are left in control. And what's happened, especially over the last few years, is that the minions of the Draco reptilians, you know, they're not as powerful. They're not as, let's just say, intelligent as the Draco reptilians in terms of their plans, in terms of the way in which they manipulate. The Draco have been doing it for millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years, all over the place. So the minions now, the deep state, are in control, and they're messing up, you know, because they're messing up because right now, from the perspective of the dark side, too many people have been awakened. Too many people have been red-pilled because of all of these failed operations. And so for the controllers, you know, this is their disaster. But of course, for the human-looking extraterrestrials that have arrived, you know, that's what they're here to see. They're seeing, well, is this experiment worthy of continuing, or do we need to just wrap it up and start from scratch again? So they're here to watch that. And what they're seeing is that humanity is kind of like awakening, because more and more people are figuring things out. And so I think, you know, in a way, this whole reptilian kind of issue is something that has led to people just waking up, realizing that something is wrong. And they're just getting multiple sources saying the same thing, that, you know, there are these off-world species that have been dominating and screwing things up on the planet, and now they've been forced to leave, and this is our chance to like move forward. But we need to be able to like say no to the kind of things that the deep state, the minions of the reptilians, are doing to bring about chaos and catastrophe on the planet.
Yeah, a couple quick questions before I jump to follow up. There is, so it sounds almost like the ancient reptilians that you're talking about were like the dinosaurs. And that is something that I've been sort of suspecting for a while lately in my research, is that, because if you look at the discovery of the dinosaurs, it was a couple Freemasons that put out the idea that there were these dinosaurs. No one else ever said that. And then they started saying, oh, I bet you we can find some bones if we look in these specific areas. And then lo and behold, these two guys started finding bones, and they were like the only ones who found them. And they would find a couple bones, and then they would hypothesize what the entire skeleton looked like based on these couple of bones. And so the ones we see in the museums are just models made by a small group of people in just the past like couple hundred years. Anyways, that's a whole other subject, but It sounds like that's what you're saying. Like these reptilians were what we would call the dinosaurs. Would you agree with that? The original ones?
Well, a lot of the dinosaurs were kind of like the food source of these intelligent reptilians that continue to exist in underground caverns. And you've had many kind of sources talk about them. I mean, they are, for example, the Nagas in Indian literature. You go to like medieval Europe, you see all of these reptilian kind of like statues, gargoyles and so forth. So these reptilian-looking beings have always been associated with ancient civilizations, with wisdom, with power. They have been around for a long, long time, and many of them are indigenous. So they're still here, but the Draco reptilians, or that are led by this off-world kind of like leadership caste called the Sakaar, you know, they've been forced to leave because they're not indigenous to the earth. What's happened is that in a way, because of the arrival of all of these advanced human extraterrestrial cultures that helped seed the planet hundreds of thousands of years ago, they're here to say, okay, well, you know, where's humanity going? And so they're just interested in seeing whether or not we are worthy of evolving into the next level or not.
And would that be what's referred to as the Orion group, the Draco reptilians?
Well, the Draco reptilians, the Orion group, they've had to leave. They had to leave,
yeah,
because they have been playing more of this manipulative role, but species that are indigenous to Earth can stay here, because it's really now up to us to show, well, can we handle it? Can we handle the existence of not just kind of like inner Earth reptilian beings, but also inner Earth insectoid-like beings like the ant people? Can we handle the existence of Sasquatch? Can we handle the existence of these inner Earth human cultures that are the descendants of, say, Lemuria and Atlantis? And then you have all the oceans as well. The bottom of the oceans, you've got advanced cultures that go back, again, hundreds of thousands and millions of years. So the extraterrestrials are wanting to see whether we, because in a way, humanity, we are the stewards of the surface of the planet. We don't really control the oceans, even though we like to think we do. But, we are still the stewards of much of the surface of the planet. And, if we are able to manage that successfully, then, we'll be given a chance to continue to flourish. Otherwise, we'll just implode. But everything I'm seeing at the moment looks like, we're going to continue to flourish because people are waking up. People are seeing the existence of these deep state manipulators. They're saying no to more wars. They're saying no to false flag operations, no to contrived pandemics. So people are waking up. I mean, not as fast as many of us would like, but it is happening.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to tell exactly how much it's happening too, because I mean, obviously there's only so much we can see from our own view and everything, but it definitely is happening. I don't know if you're familiar with the Book of Ra material, but the Book of Ra talks about a 25,000 year cycle. Every 25,000 years, there is a major event here on Earth. They call it a harvest, but it sounds much like a graduation, is with the way they're like, much like how you're describing it. This seems to correspond with the great year of the 26,000 year of the precession of the equinox, the astrological year, whatever you want to call it, where there seems to be a major shift in the ages, like we're entering into the age of Aquarius. And I can't help but think that everything that's happening is part of this process. Like, for example, if a waking up is part of this thing, then we couldn't really wake up to the evils of the deep state and of the Dracos if it wasn't for the Dracos and the deep state. So it almost seems like they were playing their part in all this. And when you read about like the apocalypse, you know, the apocalypse translates to the lifting of the veil, to seeing, you know, the truth behind the lies and everything. Would you agree with that? That it almost seems like from a grand, you know, from a divine perspective, that part of this process that we're in is being lied to and deceived and brainwashed, and then being able to come out of that on our, from our own free will, is part of this evolutionary process.
Yeah, I think The Law of One is actually a very good, very important book in terms of describing what we're going through now. And what The Law of One described as being critical was it differentiated between service to self and service to other orientations in terms of ethics. And it said that what's important for ascension is that beings either reach two levels. Either they are 95% service to self, or they are 51% service to other. And what the problem was with the earth was that there were too many that were in the middle. And what that meant was that those are people in the middle that are asleep. And so something needed to happen to wake them up. And so that's where you get this whole idea of the deep state, kind of like be in a way playing the role of forcing people to make choices, so that the evil is so in your face. You know, you look at the United States, it's so in your face that even people that are like wanting to, just do the 9 to 5, I just want to focus on my family, I just want to focus on the job, and I don't want to get involved in all these other things going on. Even they're now having to say, oh, well, gee, this is actually not a good idea to have the borders of the country opened up and had people come in without any kind of restraints, and we just house them, and we got homelessness problems. So even people that just wanted to stay asleep and say, oh, the government's handling it, they are now looking at everything and they're being forced to make choices because it's so in your face. And I think that's the key, that the Law of One material emphasizes, that, you know, everyone really needs to be making the choices. Either you're going to dictate, or either you're going to orient your life to be primarily focused on service to other, or, you know, which is kind of like hard to envisage, that you are just so incredibly evil and psychopathic that you have absolutely no empathy. But, you know, those are the two areas where one can ascend from, you know, which seems perverse, seems strange, that someone that's incredibly evil, that's more than 95% service to self, can somehow ascend. But that's what The Law of One material says. You could either got to be 95% service to self, or 51% or more service to other. But if you're in between that, then you're going to be a repeater. You're going to go through the whole 26,000-year cycle again. So this apparently is why we have been given this kind of like benefit of the harvest that The Law of One talked about, Edgar Cayce talked about, Gordon Michael Scullion, many prophets have talked about, that there would be these cataclysmic earth changes that would happen starting at the end of the 20th century. But that hasn't happened. And I think part of the reason why it hasn't happened is that the higher intelligence governing the planet, the extraterrestrials that are watching us, are saying, hey, you know, if we delay all this another few years, so many more people will wake up. So let's leave it, you know, let's just kind of let things go on and on. And now I think we've reached a point, like a tipping point. And the Law of One material said this as well. They said that it's typically what happens during a harvest is that you get like a few individuals, a few thousands of individuals kind of like ascending, you know, one way or the other. But it's very rare for a whole society to ascend, let alone a whole planetary culture to ascend. But now we're at the position where a lot of our civilization is ready to ascend, ready to go through this harvest.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that book. And I actually, that was probably my favorite part about the book, was how it described that there are two paths. One of them is service to self and one of service to others, simply just because it explained a lot to me. Like, for example, I went through my own, as we all do, we all go through our own suffering and struggling. I went through my own suffering and struggling as a child that I had to deal with and go through my own shadow work, if you will. And in the end of all that, I found forgiveness for these people, because I see that in a way I don't condone what they're doing to other people, but I can just speak for myself personally. In a way, what I went through was, I believe, part of my destiny, part of my plan, part of the lessons I needed to learn. And these perpetrators were, in a way, teachers. Like I said, I'm not condoning this service to self behavior when it comes to other people, but I just, like I said, I found peace with it. But I appreciate how that book was saying that. And the book was also saying that eventually, in this process of evolution, everyone basically ends up on service to others. The service to self is just a temporary part of the process of coming towards the we are all one, which I thought was very interesting. You were mentioning that the cataclysm was delayed. That was definitely going to be a question that I was going to have here, is the cataclysm, because in my research, since I began researching all this stuff, for whatever reason, I am always drawn back to the cataclysm. I even questioned for a while if it was like a problem with me, if I had some type of attraction to doom, and if that's why I kept going back to that. But I don't think that's what it is. It just seems like it's a big part of the story. Do you think that it's, you're saying that it was delayed perhaps by these people. So if it was delayed, then that would tell me that maybe it could be delayed again or put off, or it's not inevitable. What can you tell us about the cataclysm?
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of talk and discussion about earth changes, cataclysms, that the sun is going to go through some kind of heightened state of activity with kind of like a micronova, these incredible solar flares that trigger earthquakes, massive earth movements where you can actually have continents shifting. But I think a lot of that has been mitigated because the consciousness has risen so much. I mean, there is this kind of relationship between consciousness and earth changes. And I think the more the consciousness sinks into depravity, the worse the earth changes are, because you need to reset the whole thing, because it's like human consciousness has become so depraved. And that has happened in the past. I mean, during the Atlantean era, perfect example of where you have Plato talking about it, that the Atlanteans went on this kind of like global imperial war effort, and that led to these destructive earth changes. But what's happened now is that, in a way, we're repeating what happened with the end of Atlantis. There's the deep state is pushing really hard for the major states, like the United States in particular, to go into this kind of global war against others. But the thing is, American citizens and other people around the planet are saying no. There's just, people are saying no, we don't want America to be involved in the war. This whole Ukraine war is something that was contrived. And by and large, Americans are saying, we don't want to be involved in that. We don't want our money to go there. This is something that the elites are pushing. And the same thing with Israel, Palestine, Iran. There are forces that are trying to push to escalate the war, to make it something that just grows into a regional destruction. And all of that will lead to an kind of consciousness imploding, and that would bring about these earth changes. But what's happening is that people are saying no, and we are integrated with the planet's consciousness and the sun's consciousness. And I think at a planetary level and at a stellar level, that our global consciousness as a species is being monitored. And because we're saying no, because we're maturing and saying, no, we don't want this. We want all the nations to get along. We want the different peoples of the planet to get along. That's what we want. We're not going to fall for this kind of these contrived wars. And so I think that that's going to mitigate these catastrophes, that the catastrophes are not going to be nearly as sweeping as and destructive. These earth changes are not going to be nearly as bad as people were predicting. You know, if you go back to the predictions of Nostradamus or Gordon Michael Scallion and Edgar Cayce, I mean, they predicted incredible earth changes, and but I don't think it's going to get as bad, get as far as that, because humanity has evolved. That there more and more people are waking up to the truth, are saying no to the wars, are saying no to the global manipulation, and that I think is going to mitigate these earth changes to a great degree. I still think there's going to be some that happen, but not nearly as bad as what we predicted decades ago.
That's very interesting, because it's like, you know, a lot of people talk about how you can change your own experience, change your own reality by changing yourself, by raising your vibration, if you will. And I know, I mean, I can definitely say from experience, that's absolutely true. I've definitely, through my own efforts of growth and, you know, self-cleansing, purity, whatever, healing, I have changed my experience dramatically. And so it would make sense that on a collective, that would also have that effect. And I've heard lots of people say that as well. Like if collectively, the more of us change our vibration, focus more on love, on service to others, then we could change the world around us. I've even heard people argue that that's kind of what the game the deep state's been playing is, through the media and through mind control. They've been getting us to focus on the world that they want to see manifest, and using us almost as a vehicle to create the world that they want to see created. And that's kind of sounds like what you're saying, which, I mean, I like that. I agree. I actually live in Russia now. I moved here about 4 months ago, for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is, as a journalist in America, I didn't feel like my work was very secure there. I feel like my work is more secure here, reporting on the deep state and stuff like that. And what I found here is the people here, I think it's because the people in Russia have gone through so much suffering in the past, I mean, for centuries, but just the past 100 years alone, they've gone through so much suffering, so much more than anyone else, that they have been forced, I think, to mature to a certain level where I've noticed there's just so much unity here, and people are very respectful of each other and kind to each other. And I think that's achievable for everyone. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone wants pain and suffering. And so I hope that's where it's going. Let me ask you about disclosure. Disclosure is definitely something that there's no denying it. Like you were inspired to get into your work years ago through Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, which I remember very well. But back then, it didn't really seem to go that far. It seemed like it was mostly through Stephen Greer's effort. And there seemed to still be a great deal of resistance back then. But today is different. Today, it's clearly happening. You know, even mainstream pundits like Tucker Carlson are openly talking about it. And there does also seem to be major resistance going on, like as if there's two factions, which has been the case since Babylon and Sumer. There's always these two factions. What are these two factions? Is one, like, I've heard you mention that the military seems to be pushing for disclosure. And my question to you is, which I would agree with, my question to you, though, is, do you include the Air Force in that scenario? Because it seems to me, like in my research, like the Air Force was created in September of 1947, just a couple months after Roswell. And one of the first things the Air Force did was Project Blue Book and start creating this project of you know, making people laugh at the subject and, you know, trying to tell everyone, oh, it's not real, none of it's real. Is the Air Force some type of rogue part of this deep state alien technology, extraterrestrial technology, would you say?
Well, it's really fascinating when you look at the whole kind of U.S. military system, because it's unique on the planet as far as I can tell. I don't think any other country has anything similar to the United States, where you have like these four primary military services. Now Space Force was recently created, but they're pretty much mutually exclusive to one another. They have their own funding, their own agendas, and so you will have the Navy doing something, and the Air Force will be doing something else, and they're completely separate, and there's no real attempt to coordinate these other than a kind of funding is the only way in which there is an attempt to kind of coordinate the different military services. Now, as far as the disclosure issue is concerned, it was always pretty clear that the Navy was much more disposed or supportive of disclosure, that the Navy were the ones that were really trying to encourage some of their personnel to come forward and talk about what they saw. So, you have like in 2001 with Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project. I mean, he organized a lot of that, because he had high-level people in the Navy that were supporting him, that were encouraging disclosure to happen. And you look at the 2004 Admiral Nimitz incident and the leakage of the videos, and the pilots coming forward. Again, it's Navy that were doing that. The Air Force has always been much more aligned with the deep state, not totally, but the leadership of the Air Force has always been much more in alignment with the deep state because they thought that secrecy would serve their interests more. Whereas the Navy, they realized pretty early on that actually secrecy doesn't help the military, the United States military at all. What you want is disclosure, because without disclosure, what happened is that you have this kind of like criminal element kind of like growing. It's like a cancer throughout the whole military political system, that you have all this deep corruption to be able to hide what was really happening behind the scenes. And the Navy realized, I think probably because, I don't know if it's because of their connection to the sea or whether it's because the Navy always was having meetings with these human-looking extraterrestrials. Like they would land on aircraft carriers in the middle of the ocean. And so the Navy admirals would like meet with extraterrestrials and talk to them. And the extraterrestrials would say, look, if you can have a paradise on your planet if you started to clean things up, if you started to tell the truth. And the Navy would say, yeah, we want to, but our government is controlled by this cabal, and we do our best, but we can't succeed on our own. And so I think the Navy for decades has been really pushing behind the scenes for disclosure. The Air Force hasn't been on the same page with that. But I think more recently, the Air Force leadership kind of like had an epiphany when they recognized that the kind of technologies that they were getting through working with these reptilians, these Draco reptilians, with these German Antarctica space program and these Orion Greys, that the technologies that they were getting was kind of inferior to what the Navy was getting. When there was that realization that the Navy had the really cool stuff because they were working with these Nordic extraterrestrials, the Nordics were much more conscientious and saying, look, you really need to raise the frequency, the consciousness of your planet to be able to evolve, bring about disclosure. So I think there is this big divide between the military services, but more recently I think the Air Force has started to come on board, which I think is why you have more and more whistleblowers coming forward in the United States.
That's very interesting. I never heard that the Navy was making contact with the Nordics out at sea and that they have more advanced tech than what the Germans got in Antarctica. That is very interesting. Tonight, I'm definitely going to be going to your YouTube channel and trying to find stuff on that. I'm finishing up a report, part two of an alien series, actually, and it's mostly based on the Germans from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, all the stuff that they did in Antarctica and stuff, just because that really, I think, pertains to a lot of what we're dealing with today. What do you think Nikola Tesla fits in this? For example, Nikola Tesla, a lot of people are showing, for lack of a better word, it falls under what people call Tartaria. But people are showing a lot of images of old architecture, which is definitely very beautiful and meaningful compared to the architecture today. And they're pointing out things on the rooftops of this architecture that, I mean, they haven't proven it, but they're suggesting that it involved some type of technology, just basic natural technology utilizing the ether. And it's making me think that Nikola Tesla wasn't just a lone guy who knew this stuff, that maybe a lot of this stuff was suppressed. But that's a whole other subject. But what is interesting is, for example, Donald Trump's Uncle Fred. This is public knowledge that his Uncle Fred was handed all of Nikola Tesla's work when it was confiscated by his boss. I can't remember his boss's name, but his boss was in charge of like secret tech for the government and gave it all to Fred Trump. And Fred Trump was left alone to go over it all and hold on to it. And it's just interesting that then Donald Trump comes out and he's now in the main stage. How do you think Tesla fits into this whole drama? Have you looked into that?
I think Tesla was, you know, either a starseed or a dropped off as a baby by extraterrestrials. There are people that have talked about it, that wrote biographies about Tesla. Arthur Matthews wrote a book called The Wall of Light, and he said quite straight that he was told from extraterrestrials that he was in contact with, and that Tesla himself believed that he was dropped off as a baby by extraterrestrials with his family. And Tesla's gifts were extraordinary, and he was actually giving humanity a chance at the kind of like the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, to get all of this incredible technology that would have led to us becoming a space power in the early 20th century. And the cabal, the powers that be, said no to that. They didn't want that to happen. So they kind of like really suppressed Tesla's technologies. But still, he was able to do all these patents. He was able to have all of these incredible inventions, like at least in terms of blueprint, made available to people. And there were the people like John Trump, Fred Trump was the father of Donald Trump. John Trump is the brother of Donald Trump.
Okay. Yeah. I got it wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I got that wrong. Now, Fred Trump and John Trump were brothers. So John Trump was the uncle of Donald Trump. Okay. So John Trump, he was a high energy physicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and his specialty was in high voltage electrostatic charges. And he was the guy that was tasked by the military to evaluate Tesla's technologies to see how viable they were for all sorts of things. And so that's what he did. And John Trump did that. And I mean, it's still a secret to this day exactly what he found. But I mean, he was the one that looked at all of the Tesla's papers and decided which ones should be withheld from public circulation and which ones should be released after his, you know, apparent death in 1943. And later on, after he retired, he told a lot of this stuff to Donald Trump. And so Donald Trump learned about Tesla's technologies, the kind of advanced technologies that Tesla was trying to develop but was suppressed. So Donald Trump knew pretty early on that there was all this incredible technology out there. Some of it was being studied in elite organizations like MIT, where his uncle was a full a tenured professor. And and John Trump actually was also involved in the Roswell crash debris. I mean, there's some Majestic documents that talk about
that's interesting.
Some of the UFO craft being taken to MIT for study, and so John Trump was involved with MIT at that time. John Trump knew a lot about the secret space program because he was a scientist that could understand how high voltage electrostatics could operate. You know, if you're going to develop anti-gravity technology, what you needed to do. So he knew all of that. He knew about what Tesla had done. So I think John Trump was a prominent figure in the secret space program. And in my research, I found that the two primary institutions involved in setting up American secret space programs, both for the Navy and the Air Force, were MIT and JPL in California. And Trump, John Trump, was involved with MIT for decades. So I think Donald Trump knew a lot of this stuff, and he wanted to disclose, but he was stopped. He was prevented when he became president.
I would say Rudolf Steiner is probably in a starseed child too. And you talk about that with Tesla and everything. Rudolf Steiner is another very interesting character. Do you know anything about Otis Carr? I think his name is Otis. Otis Carr, the guy who allegedly designed a UFO that operated off of mental thought.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Otis Carr, a really good example of someone that was able to develop Tesla's ideas to their logical conclusion, to actually develop them. He was a protege of Tesla. He met Tesla, and Tesla taught him everything he knew. So Otis Carr made it his life mission to build some of these technologies that he had learned about from Nikola Tesla. And so towards the end of the 1950s, Otis Carr starts to develop this spacecraft modeled on what Tesla had taught him. And he called it the OTC-X1. He got a patent for it. He had to disguise the patent as kind of like an amusement device as opposed to a real flying saucer craft. But there it is. There is a patent for the OTC-X1. Otis Carr was able to get to build a full-scale version of the OTC-X1 and test it pretty much in the same place. I think it was in Hawthorne, California, the same place where Elon Musk started up his SpaceX. And so Otis Carr built a fully functional prototype. He had it tested. Ralph Ring was one of the engineers that was involved in that testing. And it was like, very successful, and all it needed was some giant crystal in the middle of it, and somehow the crew would interact with that crystal and they could make the whole craft fly. And so it was more a teleportation device as opposed to like we would think of as a spacecraft, you know, using jet engines to get you from A to B. It's more a craft that somehow used teleportation, that used manipulated space-time in some way through a fusion of consciousness of the crew and some big crystal in the middle. And so Otis Carr was successful in developing that, and he wanted to mass-produce these for the civilian, for civilians, for private industry. But the deep state wouldn't have anything of that. Once he successfully tested it, Ralph Ring described what happened, that the property was raided by a number of intelligence agencies, the FBI, different alphabet groups were in there, NSA and so forth, and they confiscated everything. They threatened all the technicians and engineers with jail if they talked about it, and they did eventually jail Otis Carr and kind of broke him financially, emotionally, in every way they could, because he was a threat, because Tesla's technologies really work, and they just didn't want the public to know about this. So Otis Carr is a tragic story in a way, but I think history will remember him as a great, great pioneer that was, you know, very badly treated by the deep state.
Yeah. It's a very interesting story. I think they would just focus on a color. I think Ralph Ring said they were just told to focus on like indigo or something, and then that would do it. Malaysia Airlines, the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines. Have you seen the videos that are going all over the internet about with the three orbs that circle around it and then poof, it disappears?
Yeah, I've seen that Malaysian Airlines 370, that video that's been released. I mean, that's very interesting. Some people say it's fake. I mean, the person who released it swears by it and responds to the critics. So I'm kind of like on the fence when it comes to the reality of that video. But I did interview one person, Mark Domizio. He's a secret space program witness. And he says he was taken to that he was working at Diego Garcia at an underground facility, and that one day he went up to the top, and they were dismantling, there were technicians that were dismantling the tail section of Malaysian Airlines 370. So then that dismantled parts were kind of like, I guess, dropped off in the sea to make it look like that Air 370 had crashed in the ocean. But he says that he was there. He saw the craft. He didn't see the passengers and the airline pilots, but he says his job at that time was to eliminate the workmen, the people that were working on dismantling the tail section. His job was to eliminate them. He was an assassin. And he says he did the job. So that way, you know, you tie up the loose ends. So you drop off the parts of the tail, parts of the wing, different parts of the ocean, and then they're mysteriously discovered, and so people reach a conclusion that Malaysian Airlines 370 crashed in the ocean because the pilot was deranged or something, because that seems to be the prevalent theory at the moment, that the pilot, I can't remember his name, that he just took that airline and made it crash into the ocean in a way where it would sink. And so that doesn't make sense. Why would the pilot commit suicide like that? I think what was more likely the case is that that Malaysian airline 370, that at some point the pilot was given instructions, or maybe there was an autopilot that overrode what he was doing. But one way or the other, that plane was directed to Diego Garcia. The passengers and the crew were taken off and then directed somewhere else. And the plane was partially dismantled, and parts of it were dropped off in the ocean to make it look like it had crashed.
What for? Any idea what for? Why go through all the trouble? What was on board that plane that they wanted to take?
Okay. There was a patent had been issued for some kind of software that the people who had, I think they were a group of Asians, I think maybe Taiwan, Hong Kong, I'm not sure exactly where they came from, but they had reached a patent agreement with a major US funder. I'm not sure who that major funder, can't remember whether it was the Rockefeller family or someone like that.
I've heard it was Rothschild, I think, but I
the Rothschild. Okay, yes, okay, that makes So, and there actually is a patent that was issued around that time for a product that would make billions of dollars. And so, this is typical how the deep state operates. That if there's a way of stealing the intellectual property of inventors, like these five inventors that had been sponsored by the Rothschild family, and that they were all flying on that plane. And what happened, of course, was that the plane crashes, it disappears. Now, all of a sudden, Rothschild, he's the sole remaining member of the group that had filed for the patent. So now the patent belongs to him. So he makes billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars. And, of course, that's used by the deep state for their shenanigans. And, of course, this is the corruption of the system, and that's why the Navy looked at all of this and said, "Well, if we want to progress as a civilization, if we want to one day become a galactic civilization, and kind of like interact with other galactic visitors as equals, we have to clean up our act. We have to get our shit together and stop all this kind of stuff going on, because this is corrupting us at the highest levels, and it just filters all the way down. We need to clean it up." And so that's why the Navy in particular, the US Navy, has been working with others. And I think the Russian government is also part of this kind of Navy initiative to clean up the act, which is why the deep state is so desperate to take down the Russian government and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, that would make sense. What is your take on the vaccines? You know, it's like some people say it's depopulation, but then there seems to be a nanotechnology involved in it. I don't think anyone's really completely clear as to what exactly is going on, but what's your take on all that?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. I think it's, you know, different aspects to it. One is that it's a gene altering vaccine. I mean, so it's not really a vaccine. It's really a gene altering substance, because traditionally vaccines are something that strengthen the immune system by triggering a response to a particular disease or virus by introducing some very small part of it that the body can handle and overcome by generating antibodies. These mRNA vaccines are completely different. They're really gene therapy. They're gene alteration. What they're doing is that they're altering human genes so that supposedly they can better adapt to vaccines. But I think this is just a way of manipulating human genetics so that the people that are introducing these gene altering vaccines want to be able to introduce the 8 billion people on the planet to a kind of succession of these genetic modifications through the vaccines, so that at the end of the day, at the end of the process, you have something that is a very different human to the one that existed, say, earlier on, prior to these gene-altering vaccines coming in. I think other aspects of the vaccines were to kill off a large number of people. I mean, this is part of the agenda of the deep state. I think another part of the vaccine agenda was to see how far they could push society to kind of like regulate itself, get people to turn on one another, to snitch, say, oh, this person didn't get the vaccine. He's a menace. He's threatening all of us. He should be locked away and forced to take the vaccine. They wanted to see how far they could push that agenda. So I think the deep state had a number of different goals through the vaccines, and they've learned all of this. And now they're ready to do it again.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on that. All right, I saved the best for last. A couple of years ago, you know, my job requires me to look into mostly just ugly, dark, evil things, and I've spent most of my life focusing on, you know, beautiful, inspiring things. So it gets to you after a while. And so, like a couple of years ago, for pleasure, for joy, I thought, well, I'll start watching Bigfoot movies, because I, at the time, I thought it was almost like a joke and I just thought it'd be fun and just be relaxing. And then within the first night of doing this, of this new hobby, I realized it isn't a joke. They're as real as anything else. But it has brought me peace and joy. Like, that's pretty much all I do every night when I relax, is I put on Sasquatch movies, Bigfoot movies, just because there's something about it that I find so compelling. The fact that these creatures, they seem like they're indigenous to this planet, and yet they are the masters of hide and seek. I don't, you know, a lot of people laugh at Sasquatch and Bigfoot, but I would argue they just haven't looked into it, because just with a little bit of research, it's definitely been proven, and they're definitely highly advanced creatures. I would say it seems like they're in many ways more advanced than we are. I've heard people suggest that these are the Nephilim, that these are all kinds of things. What is your take on Sasquatch? What do you think Sasquatch is, and what do you have to tell us about Bigfoot?
Well, there's a book by Sambo Truebrother called The Sasquatch Message to Humanity. And I read that book many years ago, and it really had a profound impact on me. It kind of resonated. But I didn't really talk too much about it, because I thought, well, you know, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, I mean, that's a bridge too far for a lot of people. So I'll just kind of keep it on the back burner. But, you know, as the years went on, I found more and more corroboration that this is real, that as you said, that the Sasquatch are very real. And so I kind of like went back into that book and read it again and interviewed the author. I've interviewed some other authors of Sasquatch books, Kawani Lapsaridis. He's written, he was one of the first, I think he actually wrote the first major book in the US on the Bigfoot. And then I looked at some of the ancient legends about the monkey people that were part of Hindu Vedic tradition, that these were in fact the Sasquatch. And so the more I dived into it, I found, like you, that it was very real, that they are here, that they are kind of like protectors, that they are here to kind of like help humanity learn about the secrets of the cosmos and to kind of like get ready for what's to come. That, you know, they're incredibly intuitive, they're telepathic, they operate in nature, and they really encourage people to go into nature. I was very lucky. I lived in Tennessee for a couple of years, and so I got to go to the Smoky Mountains quite a few times and hike there, and that's Bigfoot territory, and I just loved it, just being in nature. And I think, you know, whether you believe in Bigfoot or not, I think just spending a lot of time in nature, beautiful wilderness places like the Smoky Mountains, this is really a wonderful gift for yourself and for and raising your consciousness. And I absolutely believe that, yeah, if you do enough of that, yeah, definitely. You'll meet Bigfoot. They'll make contact with you, and you'll start an incredible journey. But it really is all about getting into nature, uplifting your consciousness, and getting away from the big cities. You know, if you live in a big city because you've got a job there, family, whatever, fair enough. Just whenever you can, just go out into the forests, into nature, and spend time hiking. Spend as much time in nature as you can. And the Bigfoot, the Sasquatch, you know, they'll be there. It's some way they will make contact with you, especially if you, like you're doing, watching their movies, watching the movies about them, or reading books about the Sasquatch. Yeah, you will make contact.
Well, that is a great way to end it, because I couldn't agree more. Like, just getting out in nature, spending time in nature is, I think, the easiest, most effective way of raising your consciousness. It makes me a little sad hearing about it, because I live in the big city too, but it's close enough. I can do it. I think I'll make plans tomorrow actually to get out there and take a hike. The weather is starting to get nice. And one of the researchers that I've been following on Sasquatch, that's what he says. He says they are like the managers of this place. That's their job here. And that's kind of like what you were saying. Like, they're here to sort of help us through this process. And if just by getting us to go out in nature more, I mean, that's good enough. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Really has. I'd like to do it again sometime. Like I said, I admire your work. If it were up to me, I'd be focusing completely on all these subjects that we're talking about today, because they, in my opinion, this is really at the heart of what's going on. And the rest of it is just either a distraction or the results that we're seeing on the public surface of all this other drama and exopolitics, as you coined the term, that's really going on. So thank you very much. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for having me, Greg.